pictures on.
And I'm going to buy a little paper for a while. And go ahead.
Very much for this fantastic display for Rabbi Hillman. First, if I may, to start the evening with a lot of thank yous. First, Amora Dasra, Rabbi Przanski, thank you for facilitating and allowing it to happen. Thank you very much. We have the JLE to thank. We have the phone squad to thank. We have the people who sent out the emails to thank. So it's because of this effort that we're able to have such a fantastic turnout, and we thank you very much for doing it. The most important thing that I've learned in listening to, we'll all come to understand that we're all Baal Tshuvas. There are a lot of us are Baal Tshuvas. One of the most important things that for me that I've understood is something called Aselech HaRav, to get yourself a Rav. Going with that is also with a Chavrusa. This is tremendously important. We find that little kids are always asked, well, who's your role model? You know, give me a role model. And then somehow by the time we grow up, we stop thinking in terms of role models, and we start thinking internally, well, what I have, who I am, and so on and so forth. And we forget that there are role models, that people that can inspire us, that people that can bring us to another level. This is very important. As a subheading of that, we see Rabbi Yonah brings up the idea of having a chavrusa. What's with a chavrusa and a rabbi? The idea to run ideas past somebody, not to get centered onto what you think. It's what the Masorah is thinking. What is the emes? What's in Torah? Very important. As getting over my Torah-phobic ideas, I've learned a fantastic thing is called Shema Mina. Shema Mina. Let me tell you something. Let me tell you what the way it is. Shema Mina means to listen, to hear. Hear something. Why would you think that the Gemara would say, to give you a proof, it says Shema Mina? To listen. Why not see? Well, let me show you something. See this. It says Shema Mina. It goes with the ears. There's an idea with the Mishnah. It says, where does das come from? Where does education come from? It says, from the kidneys. And people laugh at it. They say, what did they know back then? Kidneys. But if you think about kidneys, what do kidneys do? They filter out. That's the mark of somebody who's smart. That's the mark of somebody who has an educated mind. They filter out the garbage. Aselech HaRav. The Rav is being the filter. It's giving you the light, the path where to go. Aselech HaRav. There's an idea when you say Shema Mina that the word Maznayim, am I saying that right? A Maznayim is a scale to balance. That's what a teacher does. He balances the views. That's what the Mishnah is telling you. Shema Mina. Listen. You have that idea of balance. We have tonight Rabbi Kellerman, and many of you have studied with him in Israel, have studied with the Vods here in the United States, and you understand that with his background, and he's done many, many things, from sea instructor to radio personality to Rav to psychologist, he understands what balance is. He understands what it takes for a person to move. And that's what it's about, Aselech HaRav. We're very fortunate tonight to have Rabbi Kellerman to address us, to give us chizuk, especially this auspicious time. Please welcome Rabbi Kellerman.
Good evening. First, I want to offer my thanks to my close friends, the Birnbaums, who made this possible tonight. Really for assembling everything and making all the PR and everything that allowed people to come and spend the evening with me tonight. I really appreciate that very, very much. And to a hero of mine, Rev Kazansky, I've had the pleasure of hearing him speak before, and I would much prefer if actually he would be speaking and not me. But nevertheless, I understand everybody's a brave, so I'm here to pitch it. It's a very special occasion for me. I see a lot of familiar faces in the audience, a lot of students, and I'm very thankful that you came out tonight. This is, for me, the end of 8 weeks of travel, more than a dozen flights around North America, about half a dozen transatlantic flights, and going home in Mrs. Shemrite for Rosh Hashanah. And I've had my adventures for the last couple of months. So I thought I would share one story with you. Would be a nice introduction for the evening. I'm on one of these trips. I sleep between now it's averaging 2.5 to 4 hours a night. And I can move on. I'm exhausted throughout the trip. And that means that there is no issue of jet lag. Whenever I put down my head, I sleep. So I got on the plane, and I try to get the window seat whenever I get on the plane. I can immediately put my head down. I can fall asleep immediately. And I get on the plane. Before the plane even took off, there were blankets. I pulled the blanket over my head, leaned up against the seat, and I was gone. So without realizing it, I didn't realize that another fellow had actually come. He'd sat on the aisle seat, which is 2 seats away from me. He was a very large fellow. He actually took about a seat and a half. Just after the flight took off, I feel somebody poking me. So I pulled the blanket off my head, and there's this huge fellow there who looks at me and says, "Want to play?" So I just pulled the blanket back over my head. So the guy, a few minutes later, he pokes me again. So I pulled down the blanket. I said, "What do you want?" He says, "Let's play." I said, "What do you have in mind?" So he says to me, "We'll ask each other questions." He says, "I'll ask you a question. If you get it wrong, you give me a dollar. Then you ask me a question. If I get it wrong, I'll give you a dollar." So I just pulled the blanket back over my head. So he reaches over, he's shaking my leg. So I said, "What do you want?" So he says, "I'll ask you a question. If you get it wrong, you give me a dollar. And you ask me a question, if I get it wrong, I'll give you $100. I pulled the blanket down, I said, "Let's play." So he says, "I'll go first." I said, "Go ahead." So he says, "What's the largest mountain in Africa?" So my brain's not functioning. I pull out my wallet, I hand him the dollar. I said, "That's my turn." I said, "What small ethnic group originated on an island in the Northern Hemisphere? They battled successfully, 5 major cultures survived, and they now exist only on an island in the Southern Hemisphere." He looks at me and goes, "Well, that's a good question." So I said, "Think." I pulled the blanket over my head. So I fell asleep. I don't know how long it was. I hear him rummaging around. I peek out of my blanket. He's got his laptop, and he's going on GoGo, the internet service. He had to try to find. Found his keeping. It's probably a couple of hours of the trip across the country, and I feel him shaking my leg again. So I pulled out the blanket. "What do you want?" So he's handing me a $100 bill. So I said, "I don't want $100. I want to sleep. Leave me alone." So he says, no, he says, "Take." He says, "You want me? Take. I said, I don't want it." He says, "Take." "Fine, I'll take the $100. So I took the $100, I pulled the blanket over my head. So he shakes, he says, no, "What's the answer?" I said, "I don't know." Okay. Fine. Tonight I want to pose a question that there is an answer to. It's also a very, very good question. But there is an answer, and the answer has a tremendous impact on what's going to happen, God willing, on Friday night through Sunday night. for 3,300 years, we have been waiting for Mashiach. It's the greatest dream of all of Jewry. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says that this story that we're involved in is going to end one of two ways. Either Mashiach is going to come and greet a generation which is entirely righteous, or Mashiach is going to come and greet a generation which is entirely evil. That is, either Jewry will use the Torah to morally transform themselves, enlighten mankind. We will create a world which is absolutely perfect from a moral standpoint, and Mashiach will come to congratulate us. Or, God forbid, Jewry will be swallowed up in a riptide of burgeoning assimilation. Mankind will roll uncontrollably down the path that it currently seems to be following, and it'll end up in total self-destruction. So if you had to ask me which of the two of these seems more likely, so I, at this point in my life, do not have much of a doubt. And again, I'm open-minded and I'd be willing to hear an objection. But it seems to be pretty clear which of these two scenarios it's going to be. Today, rates of white collar, blue collar, and violent crime throughout the first world have never been higher. The two most famous atheists of the last generation, Stalin and Hitler, murdered more people than were killed in the Crusades, the Inquisition, and the Jihad all taken together. Today, the most inhuman, the most excruciating forms of torture methodically practiced by scores of governments worldwide. A colleague of mine, Professor George Steiner, recently told a group of his students at the University of Kent at Canterbury, quote, "There is hardly a methodology of abjection and of pain which is not being applied somewhere at this moment to the individuals and groups of human beings. Moreover, even the most civilized nations fail to provide haven from this spiraling human malevolence." There was recently a terrifying study by Stanford University professor Donald Lund. Lund found the following, quote, "Statistically, a child born anywhere in the U.S. today has a 1 in 200 chance of being murdered sometime during their lifetime. A child born and growing up in high crime areas of certain cities, like Atlanta or Philadelphia, is far more likely to be murdered, a 1 in 50 chance. Children raised in the Tenderloin or Fillmore areas of San Francisco have a 1 in 70 chance of being murdered. And these are only the rates for murder, not the rates for something like rape, which is four times as common in the United States as murder. Our political leadership, from the local, the municipal, to the state, to the national level, have proven themselves to be crass, rude, and thoroughly corrupt. And I'm talking about today's newspaper, and you can go back for the last 5 years. Selfish is ubiquitous among the non-criminal. Divorce, spousal abuse, child abuse are at epidemic levels. In an unbelievable move, one state, Oregon, recently passed a law allowing any two doctors with patient consent to perform euthanasia. And HMO executives considering lobbying for similar bills in their respective states have already convened committees to consider how the option of substituting euthanasia for esoteric treatments might enhance their corporate profitability. These are considerations given today's economy. Neither are the leaders of other countries any more refined. Whether it be Italy, I'm sure you've been reading the newspapers, or China, or Denmark, or the former Soviet Union, Russia, I was just in Russia for a few weeks, The level of corruption around the world is over the top. Private industry and governments worldwide are prostituting themselves, there's no better word, offering for the right price virtually any service or product, no matter how dangerous or despicable. And amidst this backdrop, according to the latest statistics, jewelry, which was intended to be the light unto mankind, and we were supposed to help mankind out of this homemade hell, we are now committing cultural and demographic suicide. Just 5 weeks ago, on August the 6th, there was a historic announcement in Jerusalem. Two of the most famous demographers on the planet, Barry Cosman and Ariella Kesar of Trinity College, who, interestingly, have now taken the position, they both direct a center at Trinity College called the Center for the Study of Secularism in Society. So their lead study, which has made tremendous waves in the world, is a study called the American Religious Identification Survey, just released, reveals the following findings. One, since the last major study of American Jewry, which was conducted in 1990, the National Jewish Population Survey, since 1990, more than half of all marrying Jews have married non-Jews, with the result that mixed Jewish, non-Jewish families are growing at twice the rate of homogeneous Jewish families. The number of Jews in America who identify themselves as Jewish has dropped between 1990 and today by 750,000 people. That is, 750,000 people have disappeared from the scene since 1990. More shocking, this is what really pushed me over the edge. Of the 5.3 million Jews in America today who do identify themselves as Jewish, Cosman's study from Trinity College indicates that only 3.6 million are actually Jewish according to a matrilineal line. That is, only 68% of those Jews in America who claim that they're Jewish are, according to the traditional halachic definition, actually Jewish. 32% of the Cohens and Schwartzes out there, and it's usually the people with the Jewish last names, 32% of them are not Jewish, halachically. And truly, the most shocking, Cosman revealed that the rot is not just on the fringes of our community. He discovered that 44% of those people who call themselves religiously observant Jews declare that their worldview, as opposed to being Jewish, they define their worldview as a secular worldview. These people are walking the walk, they are talking the talk, and they're already spiritually gone. So it's only a matter of time before the intermarriage statistics start to reflect that. And we're not talking here about the people who are already assimilated. We're talking about those who are religiously observant, according to their own definition. Cosman made the comment to the New York Times, quote, "I attribute the shift to a combination of disaffection from Judaism and intermarriage." That's what you're watching. A people who fell out of love with Torah. So it certainly seems the Jewry, at least on the surface, it appears that we have failed the test of America. Either it was that our our great-grandparents, our grandparents, and great-great-grandparents fled their respective countries to America under such dire circumstances that the building of those generations just did not have time to prepare them for the tests that we're looking at here in America, which is certainly possible. Or it could be that just no one could possibly fathom what it would require to withstand the tests of vast wealth and the educational and social challenges that were waiting for us in America's universities. Because that's really where the unraveling took place, according to all the statistics. Whatever reason, current intermarriage statistics suggest that you and I are going to witness the loss of approximately, the rate is actually going to increase, but approximately we're going to watch 1 million American Jews disappear every 10 years for the next 3 decades. Most of us will be alive to actually witness this. Now, these are not the wild musings of an alarmist. These are cold, hard facts based on the last 25 years of demographic data. I remember 25 years ago hearing alarmists predicting this, but it happened. It's done. It's over now. So getting back to my question, which of the two scenarios will it be? Will Mashiach come to greet a righteous generation or an evil generation? We live in darkness. And we understand how humanity can really dig itself into a pit, an inescapably deep pit, which we could just never climb out of. But how do you understand the Talmud's first scenario? What was the Havamina? When someone reads the Gemara, how could they possibly defend the other side that maybe, the story might turn out okay? Numerically, we are insignificant. That is, the one-third of 1% of mankind, Jewry, and the 10% of them that have some inkling of Shabbos and the other 9 commandments that were on those tablets. We who possess the barest understanding of how human beings function. We grew up in the Holocaust shadow, bereft of teachers, bereft of parents, robbed of tradition. How are we supposed to understand how the story could have a happy ending? Realistically, where is there any hope? In case the point is not graphically clear to you, think about it from a historical perspective. The Vilna Gaon and the Baal Shem Tov failed to bring Mashiach. The Yosef Cairo failed to bring Mashiach. Rashi, Ramban, Rambam failed to bring Mashiach. Ravina and Ravashi failed to bring Mashiach. Yudah Nasi failed to bring Mashiach. Mordechai and Esther failed. The Maccabees failed. Ezra failed. Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, they failed to bring Mashiach. Shmuel, Eliyahu, Elisha, they failed to bring Mashiach. And we're going to bring Mashiach? So if you ask me which of the two scenarios is it going to be, I don't think anyone here would have any complaint. I don't think anyone could really argue with me. Certainly, I don't think you'll argue with me in about 30 minutes when I confess that it is clear as day to me that Mashiach is going to come and greet a generation which is entirely righteous. And I'll try to explain. There's a principle in the Gemara, a principle in the Mishnah, that says, Lefum Sara Agra, according to the difficulty, so is the reward. Now, as Jews, we don't believe in some sort of synthetic reward. That is, you know, you do 100 mitzvahs, and when you get to the next world, you get 100 Hallel Yisrael Three Musketeers bars. That's not how it works. We believe that somehow there's an intrinsic connection between the reward that we get and who we become in this world. Or another way of saying that is when we say the samsara agra, the reward is according to the struggle, what we mean is that the amount of life that we as individuals produce is a function of how hard we struggle. It turns out that spirituality in this world is not determined by some objective standard of what you did or how much you know, but by how hard you try to do the right thing. How much you were willing to step forward when the call came. That's the ultimate measure of a human being, your willingness to step forward when it's frightening or when it's difficult. So theoretically it's possible that even though I might know a lot less, and I might achieve objectively on a behavioral scale much less than somebody else, it could be that I'm releasing far, far more light. That the reward will be far, far greater. The impact on the universe will be far greater if it requires more struggle on my part. The key is that you make the effort to step forward. There's a fascinating medrash. If you don't know much about history, the medrash reads like oatmeal. It's quite boring. And if you know a little bit about history, the medrash is shocking. The Pasuk in Kohelet says, Al tomar mehaya. Don't say, what happened? Oh, the old days. Say, Yanin Rishon Hayu Tov Neila. The old days were much better than these days. The Pasuk says, don't say that. Amar Vibrach. Rebrach explained, what does it mean, don't say that? See, there's a pasuk in Dibrei Yamin. V'yoyada hanagi l'aron. V'yoyada was the instructor, the guide, the mentor of Aaron. Mentors is very bothered. Yoyada was the mentor of Aaron. Aaron lived 450 years before Yoyada ever showed up on the planet. Yoyada was the mentor of Aaron? The Midrash explains, Ella, Iluhaya Aaron, Kayan Bedorosho Yoyada. If Aaron would have lived 450 years later, and he would have lived in Yoyada's generation, Yoyada had Hayagadomi Menu Bishata. Yoyada would have been greater. Now, how does that work? You read Sedoros, Yoyada was a nothing compared to Aaron. Objectively, Aaron's Nebu was greater. Aaron's Torah knowledge was greater. Aaron's Maisim were greater. So how can you say that Yoyada would have been greater had Aaron been alive in that generation? The answer is that Aaron lived in a generation of light. It was so clear. It was so much easier. Yoyada lived in a generation of darkness. And his struggle was so intense that he could have been a great Rebbe for Aaron. Where does our strength come from? Where does power come from? It comes from openness and integrity and the courage to step forward and do the right thing when you are called upon. I, like you, was probably up. You were probably up also very early this morning, very late last night. I'm sure that you are not overburdened with sleep these days. What on earth are you doing here tonight? To my knowledge, no one gets a university degree for this lecture, and there are no continuing educational credits. You get no cupboard, we're not putting your name up on the wall. There's no educational stipend for being here. So why did you schlep out of a nice, comfortable house and come and sit here tonight? What are you doing here? I think that you sense the truth of what I'm saying when I say it. I'm not complimenting you. I'm describing the reality. You're heroes. You're more responsibly individuals. You came here seeking clarity. You came here seeking direction, inspiration. You want to do the right thing, and you're hoping you get the injection that allows you to do it. That's called heroism in the 21st century. By coming out tonight, you stepped forward. Wasn't terribly difficult, but it's a challenge. It's a challenge not everybody lived up to. I want to tell a very personal story. I'm 48 years old. I do not have a large number of close friends, but I do have a few, very few. And these are people that I collected over a lifetime, who I'm so proud to have any sort of association with. I don't have a lot because I'm very, very picky. I want to tell you a story tonight about a close friend, someone I'm very proud to call a close friend, who I met when I was 22 years old. My friend, his name is Alex. He's a very idealistic individual. That's a minimal requirement in my world. When I met, I was getting very excited about Torah. I remember that summer I met Hannah, who I married, and I met Alex, and the three of us became the closest of friends. And Alex, in his idealism, decided that he wanted to get up and move to Israel. He wanted to send Jewish lives. Alex is so idealistic. When he arrived at Ben-Gurion, he went up to a customs agent there, and he told the customs agent that I'd like to be drafted because I want to serve in the army. And the customs agent told him, this is customs, we don't draft. And also, if you want to be drafted, that probably means you're crazy and they won't take you. He went down to the Katzin Ha'ir the day after he arrived in Israel. And he pounded on the door and said, take me, I'm ready. And they said, you know, we don't even talk to you for 3 months. And he said, then I'll sue. And Alex fought his way in to an interview to the army before the 3 months ever came near. They interviewed him, and it turns out Alex has flat feet and asthma. So they rejected him, and he was not fit to serve in the army. And Alex fought, and fought, and fought. And they said to him, you'll never make it. And he fought his way into the army, and the Israeli army accepted Alex. And as soon as Alex was accepted, he applied for an officer's training course. And they said to him, you just arrived in the country, maybe you should wait 6 weeks. And he fought and fought and fought, and it was many, many months, but eventually he was actually accepted into this officer training course. And Alex was training as an officer, actually, while my wife and I went to Israel, and we were studying yeshiva, and Alex used to stay by us on Shabbos in those days, and tell us the stories of his officer's training course. And as soon as he became an officer, he immediately applied for transfer to the Dudvan, Israel's most elite paratroop unit. And, of course, last year, asthma, they told Alex, you're not really qualified, and he already had a reputation. He fought and fought and fought, and Alex made it into the Dudvan. And as soon as Alex was in the Dudvan, he applied for an officer's training course. And Alex fought his way up the ranks until eventually he actually became second in charge of one of the most elite troops in Israel, the troops that performed the secret Entebbe-type missions. This was the group that he was actually in charge of, or second in charge. One of the most beautiful things about Alex is that Alex is not just a warrior, he's a poet. He's mamish, he's a David Melech of our generation. He's a poet, he's an artist, And I think for many reasons this speaks to me. And throughout his officer's training course, Alex wrote the most beautiful poetry, and he did these watercolor drawings from the bases. And I have copies of many of the watercolor drawings in my house, and I have a book that I've collected of his poetry, spectacular poetry. I want to read to you a poem that Alex wrote on August 17, 1986. That week he was completing the officer training course, and he was going to take over as the second in command of this very elite unit. Alex wrote as follows. Once in a while, as I progress towards the course's end, I feel a pang of fear. If the war comes, when the war comes, I will have to lead men to die. And I will have the calm power to yell to them or to whisper, Kadima, step forward. And I will have the calm power to step forward myself. Alex only wanted to do the right thing. That's all that drove him. That was his only motivation in life. That's why I love him so much. One year later, on September the 15th, 1987, his 25th birthday, there were Hezbollah in the southern cliffs of Lebanon that were tossing Katyushas onto Israel's northern communities. And Alex's unit was sent up by helicopter in the middle of the night to capture terrorist units in the Hardov region. Alex's unit was ambushed. His commander was very badly wounded and was trapped alone under enemy fire. And in that moment, Alex was automatically promoted to achieve his dream. He was the commander of Israel's most elite unit. And at that moment, my friend, my idealist, my hero, was faced with a choice. Do I back out and come back tomorrow when it's safe and clean up the mess? Or do I step forward and try to save my comrade's life? My good friend Alex stepped forward to aid his commander and fell to a terrorist bullet on a rocky cliff in southern Lebanon. I don't have first-hand knowledge of what's happening in America's smaller Jewish population centers, those with Jewish populations under 50,000. There the data is scarce. I do know that Denver's intermarriage rate is over 70%. Vancouver's is more than 75%. There are cities throughout the southeastern part of the United States where Jewish life has ceased altogether, where the Gentiles are landmarking old synagogues as a reminder of Jewish communities that once flourished there. There are 625,000 adult American Jews currently practicing other religions that we can identify. There are a million American Jewish children under the age of 18 that are being raised as non-Jews, or with no religion at all. And you have to know the rot goes much further. Of this 5.5 million Jews are called the core group. Only 2 million even belong to a synagogue or donate to a Jewish charity. We've lost almost 4 million Jews. That's a greater percentage of Jews than were lost in the Holocaust. And what's more amazing is, there's no uproar, there's no sense of urgency, there's no emergency meetings taking place. So far, there have been 19 Holocaust memorials that have been built. Over $500 million in capital expenditures have been allocated for these Holocaust memorials, and only pennies are being given to innovating Jewish education. Billions are being raised for dead Jews, and we can't scrape together the basic capital to keep our children alive. This is the new reality. Never before in Jewish history has our people been led by an oligarchy, by people who have come to power simply by virtue of their wealth, who are almost entirely bereft of any sort of Jewish knowledge. You don't have to be a veteran sociologist to see the handwriting on the wall. We're probably witnessing one of the last generations of organized American Jewish life as we know it today. According to the latest study, every year, there are approximately, in America, approximately 2,000 new Balei Tshuva. And every year, about 3,000 Jews join Jews for Jesus. We have to convey our message to all of Jewry. We have to teach hundreds of thousands. Perhaps we have to access millions of them. We must touch them. We have to show them that our religion is filled with positive, joyous concepts. That Shabbos and the Jewish laws governing sexuality have never been more relevant in Jewish history. We have to communicate this message through love and through caring and through sharing. I believe, and I tend to be conservative and sober in this regard, but I believe that we've got about 5 to 10 years to make the crucial move that can determine which of the two ways the story ends. And I believe we can do it. Depending on personality, you either hear a very light echo or a booming voice calling you to step forward. So what exactly is the challenge of the day? How do we turn the whole thing around? When you're called to step forward, what's being asked of you? So again, I tend to be very conservative. I'm not terribly innovative. I'm a reactionary by nature. I think we have to start with the most fundamental areas. If you want turned off, alienated, Jewishly ignorant, secular Jews to join Judaism, then Judaism has to have something spectacular to offer. And therefore, the very first address for quote-unquote Kiruv is right here. And so close to home, it is terrifying. This is something that all rabbis in the field today are aware of, psychologists are aware of. It's right here at home, in our marriages. And although I will admit that perhaps in the Orthodox world things are a bit better, but the walls between the Orthodox world and non-Orthodox world are entirely permeable. And everything that's happening on Madison Avenue and Wall Street washes right into our synagogues. More than anything, we have to build a model Jewish marriage that will blow away someone in the mainstream, that they should take a look and say, that is unbelievable what you've created. I was counseling a man 2 days ago, and I sensed, because of things that were going on with the children, I sensed perhaps there was a Shalom Bayis issue. And I asked him, how's your Shalom Bayis? And he said, it's fine, it's really fine. And I said, really? He says, yeah. We hardly fight. That's the mainstream measure of marriage. We hardly fight. As long as you don't fight too much, then you've achieved the ideal. I pushed a little further and I discovered that this couple spends time alone at most about once every 6 to 8 weeks. And it's really quite fine. Everything's okay. No alarm, no concern whatsoever. If you can hear the call to step forward, it's saying if you haven't read a good book on marriage in the last 5 years, you're due for a new vaccination. You're looking for recommendations? If you can manage the Hebrew, the Mishkan Yisrael for men is unbelievable. The Ol Rachel is a life-changing experience. Recommended for ladies. You want English? The shelves of your local Jewish bookstore are packed with books on marriage. Perhaps a telling sign of what's going on in our world today. And of course, even if the marriage is in great shape, and I mean great shape by Jewish standards, that you're head over heels in love, that you giggle every time you think of your spouse, if this sounds like fairy tale, then we've been affected by what's going on out there. The Gemara says, why does a woman go into Nida? So that every month you feel like it's the honeymoon all over again. And that's not a metaphor. That's what it's really like. That's normal. That's mainstream. That's Torah. And if you aren't experiencing that, it's broken. We've been affected. The assimilation has gotten to us. The first step is we have to go back to having normal Jewish marriages. That's the center of the whole project. And again, to say, well, like, you know, we're fine. We don't fight. Like, why shake up the ship? It's okay. It's not so challenging to go out and read a book. I do a lot of marriage counseling these days, unfortunately. 90% of the people who come to me, their marriage is on the rocks. But there's this amazing, amazing, heroic 10% that show up in my office. I had a young couple that came to me. Just married. A very wise young couple, just married. So they didn't meet me at the office, they met me in my house, and I was on the phone, my wife left it in, and she showed me into my kitchen, and we had a sliding wooden door that separates my kitchen from the rest of the house. My wife closed the door so they could have privacy, and my wife came and told me, they're waiting for you. So I finished my phone call, and I came, and I, as I always do, I knocked on the door before I walked in. When I walked in, they must not have heard my knock, because they were very busy. So I closed the wooden door and I tried again. And I opened the door again. Okay, now they had moved into 2 seats. And I came and I sat down in front of them and I said, you know, can I help you? And they said, yeah, we came for some advice on marriage. And I looked at them and I said, to be honest, it looks like your marriage is doing just fine. You know? You need some advice, actually. They said, no, but we think you can always make it better. What a mature couple. I know couples in their 40s and 50s who wouldn't think of doing such a thing. You go to a Rav and you say, everything's great, we want to make it better. What a mature couple. What a spectacular couple. That is the future. That's how the story could turn out to be okay. That's stepping forward. Call number two. We need to help our children fall so in love with their Yiddishkeit that any time they bump into something Jewish, they laugh and giggle. That the sweetest thing in their life is Torah. I remember I was learning by Rav Shlomo Volba, and he taught me this ancient Jewish minhag, that when you take a child to cheder the first time, he comes wrapped in a talis, and you bring him to cheder, and the Rebbe holds him on his knees. This actually happens to my boys. Rebbe holds him on his knees, and the Cheder Rebbe takes Othiot, Hebrew letters, they're smeared with honey, and he gives the child the letters to lick the honey off the letters. So Vogel explained the minute to me. Your Vogel was not being romantic. He said, the reason we do that is the bitterest the Torah should ever taste. Only sweeter from that point forward. I don't know how to do that. How do you make it that sweet? How do you make it sweeter? So Baruch Hashem, we have Talmid Chachamim. We have people we can go to. There are experts in Chinuch out there. They're selling Kindle sold outside. There are things that can be done to learn about this. I've been an advocate for years. It's mikubal, it's accepted within our community that a couple does not get married without passing the kala classes. And religiously people go to the classes. But why do those classes end when they get married? Why don't they just segue into child raising classes? Why isn't that the normal next step? When are these people supposed to learn about raising kids? What is that supposed to happen? At age 65 when I go over my regrets? And more, in the schools, thank God, I believe the Orthodox schools are far, far better than the alternatives. Far, far better than the alternatives. There's no comparison. But I'm not interested in the mainstream standard. I want to know what does the Torah say it should look like. And the tragic reality is that we have a very long ways to go. A friend of mine, over the summer, he was so enthusiastic, his child is arriving the first day in kindergarten. He's arriving the first day in kindergarten. And I'm sorry, it wasn't kindergarten, first grade. He's arriving the first day in first grade. And he's going to have a Rebbe in first grade. And the father, over the summer, to prepare his child for this, he learned with him the first parak of Pirkei Avot. And the child made a seum with his father. The father asked the shiloh, and the rabbi said, it's okay. He made a seum with his child, with his first grader-to-be, in Pirkei Avot, in the first parak. And the father wrote a note for the Rebbe that I want you to know what a Choshek Talmud you have, that he spent his summer learning Pirkei Avot with his father. He made a seum in the first parak yesterday. And the father gave the note to his son and said, you give this to your Rebbe when you arrive so that he knows who you are. And the boy came, he came to school, and he had his first day, and he came home, and the father said, what did your Rebbe say? Did you give him the note? And the boy said, I gave him the note. And he said, what did your Rebbe say? He said, he didn't read it. It's a mistake. It's far, far, far better in our world, but there's a long, long ways to go. In many ways, we've been affected by the secular environment. I went to certainly one of the top three high schools in America. Horrible experience. One of the top three high schools in America. Academically, the people from my high school got into every Ivy League on the planet. Right? We were the top. I took AP everything. I remember, we didn't have anybody with master's degrees teaching us. At my high school, every teacher that we had had a PhD, including the gym teacher. My AP English teacher, she had a PhD in English. My AP history teacher had a PhD in history. My AP calculus teacher had a PhD in mathematics. In 4 years, in one of the top schools in America, I never had a teacher who studied education. They were brilliant, they just couldn't teach. And we've been affected by that. Who do we choose to teach Gemara? A guy who loves Gemara. Who do we teach to teach our kids English? A person who loves English. But what is their training in Chinuch? Revolva told me that when you take your child to a school, one of the first questions you have to ask the principal of the school to know if you should put your child in that school is, what is the educational approach of this school? If the principal doesn't understand the question, there's a problem. A school is supposed to have an educational approach. What's the goal? What's the methodology? How do you do it here? It's not just that we sit down and we stuff them with facts. There's more to chinuch than that. If we want to attract the rest of Klal Yisrael to join what we're doing, We have to take what is today the finest educational environment in the world and raise it up a couple of notches. It's got to go up. Then we'll have something to sell. We have to change our marriages. We have to change the way that we as parents relate to our kids and the way that our teachers relate to our kids. This is what it means to step forward. And although you could probably have the long encyclopedic list, I'm only going to mention one more item tonight and then I'll conclude. Perhaps most importantly, I need to do avoda. That term should ring to be clear to us what that means. It's one of the three pillars on which the world stands. I need to do avoda. Avoda means, in a professional fashion, like a pro, in an organized, in a refined, in a well-thought-out way, I work on my nidos. The reality is that Orthodox nidos are spectacular. It happened to me more than once that I've been on a plane that was indeterminably delayed. Everyone's going to have to sleep in the airport. And I can walk up to a person who's standing there wearing a kippah and say, I'm stuck, and he says, come home with me and I'll give you a hot meal. Happened to me more than once. None of my non-Jewish friends on the plane can do that. Orthodox Jews are unbelievable. Don't let the Sutton persuade you differently. They are so many steps above and beyond. You need a place for Shabbos in any city in the world, you know you can just show up. And perhaps as I travel, I appreciate this very, very much. My wife is just stranded in France. And she had no place to be on Shabbos. She made one phone call. That person called somebody who called somebody who called somebody, and she had a place for Shabbos. In the middle of summer when everyone was away. We are an unbelievable community. The Achnas is Orchim. I have a child who was very ill when he was born. Many of you know the story. And he required about $750,000 in emergency medical care. Of course, the surgeon who operated on him was an Orthodox Jew and wouldn't take a penny from me because I was learning in Kollel. Of course not. And we couldn't find a way to transport the child from Israel to America for the surgery because Israel didn't have the electronic equipment that we needed to move this one. And out of the blue, a rabbi showed up, a tzaddik, by the name of Rabbi Fierer. He just said, you know, listen, don't worry about it. We've got an incubator like that near Paris. We'll get to Paris by tonight. We'll get into Tel Aviv by tomorrow night. We'll get to Al-Fir here also. Don't worry about a thing. We'll work it out with LL technologists and we'll make sure the TWA is prepared for the transfer. And but don't worry, it's all set. That's the community that I live in. We live in an amazing, amazing community. But if you want to turn all of Jewry around, it's not enough yet. We have to work on our midos. And working on your midos doesn't mean, well, I go to a shir. You can lay there as long as you want. They can't do anything for you. They can't change you. If as a result of the shir, you get up and you say, I'm going to now change something, I'm going to do something, I'm going to walk out tonight, I'm stepping forward. I'm going to make a change in the way that I live. It wasn't just a shir. From now on, X, then, that's called avoda. That's what's required. Avoda told me in the old days in Europe, you can grab a wagon driver, pull him off the street and say, what are you working on? He would tell you what need he was working on. That's the way that we used to look pre-Hitler. And that's what we're going back to now. I know in this community there are people who are working on nidos in a very serious and organized fashion. I know there's other communities all around the East Coast, the West Coast like this. And it's in more than one country. Jewry, thank God. Here's the call. Thank God we step forward. I'll leave you with a thought, a blessing, and a challenge. And then I'll draw my conclusion about whether or not the story will end up one way or the other. The thought is as follows. Friday night, many of you will be in this room. Sunday, all of us are going to hear the blast of the shofar. There's a famous stira in what exactly the blowing of a shofar is. Rav Yisrael Salanter and the Yaros Dvash both say it's an amazing secret. The blowing of the shofar is the moment when the din actually takes place. That's the moment when the malachim grab your neshama, they drag you into the court. Hashem presses the button and you get some spiritual x-ray, they read the MRI and they say, this is your din for the year. It's during the moment of the blowing of the shofar. The blowing of the shofar, according to Yaros Dvash and Rishon Lezion, is the moment of pure and unadulterated din. Pure judgment. The contradiction is a famous midrash. The midrash is on the pasuk. Ashei ha'am yodea truva. How fortunate is that people, the Jews, who know how to blow a truva. The midrash says, how fortunate are the Jews who know to blow a truva? Any non-Jewish trumpeter could blow a truva. What's the big deal? And the Midrash answers, no, how fortunate the Jews who know how to blow the Truah, that gets Hashem to step off the Kisei Hadin and sit down on the Kisei Harachamim. It gets God to get off the throne of judgment and sit down on the throne of mercy. The blowing of the shofar is a time of pure mercy. Or is it a time of pure din? So the answer, the Ruch Lubavitch of Mir says this, for Bolda echoed these sentiments. The answer is, when we blow the shofar, that is a voice coming from deep inside of us. It's a voice, if you know how to blow the shofar, and each of you will be blowing your own shofar on Sunday, it's a voice that cries out and says, I don't want to be stuck anymore. I don't want to be like this. I want to grow. And I know that you can't grow unless you do something that's difficult and painful. And I don't want easy and comfortable. I'm willing to do difficult and painful. Hashem, I will do it myself. I will work on myself. I will make changes in my life. When a Jew calls out to God and says, I will do it. I'm not afraid of doing things that are hard or difficult. I will do it. This year you'll see I'm going to do it. That is the moment of pure din. Hashem is saying, what will you give? And the Jew says, I will give. And God gets off the throne of judgment and sits on the throne of mercy. He says, gloves off of this lady. Take your gloves off of this fellow. They're going to be fine. They're going to make it. They're willing to work on themselves. The blowing of the shofar is when God calls, step forward. And at that point, either you don't stand, or you do. I start tonight with a conclusion and a challenge that Yeshiva is going to come to the generation, which is entirely righteous. I want to try to explain to you why that's true. I'm going to do it right now. This is real. This is not a show. There's a bunch of Jews sitting in a room a few days before Rosh Hashanah. If anything that I said made sense to you tonight, if you understand that the only hope is stepping forward, personally and nationally, if in your head you have things that you know God wants of you, and whatever that is, it's none of my business, it's none of the person sitting next to you's business, it's between you and God. But if you think there's something that God wants of you, perhaps something relevant to what we spoke about tonight, and if you're willing to step forward and commit before you walk through the doors tonight, if you're willing to commit between you and God and take a step forward, then please stand up. That's why I'm certain how the story will end. Jihad Shana Tova Matuka. Yeah.